In the fabled land of Northern California, nestled in the Valley of Sacramento, two friends begin a journey to enlighten the world about their experience living life as a Xenial. But what is a Xenial, you may ask? If you wish to know, then follow them on their adventures.
Welcome to the Xenial Chronicles. This is James.
This is Mike.
And for this episode, I have a special inspiration. It's an inspiration that's near and dear to my stomach, I guess. Because my stomach rules me in many ways, even more than my heart does. Although it's a bad day to say that, since tomorrow is actually mine and my wife's 19th wedding anniversary, 19 years of being married. But even she knows that the stomach is the best way to reach me. I think a few minutes ago she was even asking me, "Hey, what do we have? What do you want to have for dinner tomorrow? It's our anniversary." So that was her main thought about our anniversary, is what I might want for dinner, because the stomach leads, and literally it leads the way. I mean, my stomach projects out more than any other part of my body. So it's what kind of literally more than any other part. But it's what kind of motivates and drives me forward in just about everything that I do. You know, it's what makes me sneak away when I get the opportunity to go grab a hamburger at Five Guys. You know what I mean? Because their burgers are so good, as we discussed in a previous podcast.
Yes, yes.
But there's a specific food item that I kind of wanted to talk about, a much maligned food item, at least here in California, I'd say, depending on what racial group or ethnic group that you belong to. This is a maligned food item.
But really?
Some groups see this as a great food item. And there's kind of three things that, other than the item itself being something I love, there's three things that kind of keep it always fresh in my memory. One of them is a friend of mine who passed a few years ago.
Oh, okay.
This was one of the foods that he really liked because of actually where he grew up. And it was something that him and I did share together on a few meals before
He
did pass.
Okay.
There's also a connection that I always find amusing and always makes me think of when I think of this food. I think of an Adam Sandler movie, one of his weirder movies. Some people, and even I, think that there are moments in it that are kind of sweet, but at the same time, it's sweet and yet super disturbing.
Interesting. Okay.
And then the other thing that has recently brought this back to my mind is my sister-in-law. And so I'll discuss the friend connection later once I start discussing what this food item is, really.
Okay.
It'll come up later as far as when I talk about where he's from. But let's start with the Adam Sandler movie. The Adam Sandler movie I'm speaking of is, in fact, this actually talks about the location immediately, 50 First Dates.
Oh, okay.
Is the Adam Sandler movie, which,
right,
again, I think it's kind of I think it's kind of sweet that he does what he can to make this woman fall in love with him every single day. Spoilers: if you have not seen the movie, she loses her memory every night. If you haven't, I mean, it's what, a 20-year-old movie, so people,
right,
you need to have seen the damn thing.
Almost at this point, but you can almost glean that from the title of the film too. When you really think about it,
and you would think,
yeah.
It's kind of sweet that he loves her enough. He wants to put in the effort to make her fall in love with him every single day for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
But it's also, that's also kind of a little creepy in some ways, especially
I guess when you think about it,
before he makes the video and the book and stuff for her, he's kind of a stalkery guy that is stalking her literally every single day. So it's a little bit, but it's both creepy, but there's always that fine line where something can be sweet and creepy at the same time. And it just depends on what the intention is, whether it's sweet or whether it's creepy. You know what I mean?
If you can go to
a restaurant and like order the exact food that your significant other wants and would like to eat, know every single part of the exact food they would want to eat, or make it exactly a full meal exactly as they would want it to be with dessert and all of that stuff.
Right.
That could be both super, super sweet, but also depending on whether they're your significant other or they're just somebody that you've been watching, it could be super, super creepy. It just depends on what your relationship is and what the intent behind it is.
Right, right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, attention can go multiple ways here.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Sometimes it's a good thing you've been paying attention. Sometimes it means you've been looking through binoculars in my window, in my blinds, and you notice the birthmark on my ass. So, I mean, you know, it's a toss up there.
It's a very good point.
But in that movie, at one point, there's discussion of Spam and Reese's. And here's the thing. We're not talking about Reese's today. What we are talking about is Spam.
We're talking about
Spam. Is our topic.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. Spam, luncheon meat in the can. probably something that most people, I won't say most people. There's a lot of people that have a strange opinion of it. And most of them are people that have never had the opportunity to try it. Never right. See what it was like.
Right.
And Spam has a very interesting history. It's 51st Dates, for instance, takes place on Hawaii, and it's mentioned in that movie as a food item. And again, a joking thing of making Spam and Reese's together, which horrible combination, I think.
I was going to say you were saying at the same time, like
yeah, that's
simultaneously
in the
mouth. That doesn't sound like a good idea at all.
Yeah, the guy that the character in the movie, he's called Tattoo Face. He works as the cook at a restaurant.
That's terrible.
He mentions he offers to make Spam and Reese's for Adam Sandler's character. By the way, I've watched this movie a bunch of times because again, it runs that line between creepy and sweet. I think it's sweet, and I love watching it. It's one of my movies that puts a smile on my face when I'm feeling crappy.
That's great.
Just a funny. It's a funny, stupid, enjoyable movie. Funny because I am not a fan of Drew Barrymore at all, but I do like Adam Sandler. I like Sean Astin, and Sean Astin plays probably one of the best characters he's ever played. Although almost everything Sean Astin does is fantastic.
I've been a fan. I gotta see this again. I really do. I haven't seen it in well over a decade.
Well, and it's actually a fairly good part played by Rob Schneider in this.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, he plays because Rob Schneider he walks that line again. We're talking weird lines that people walk of being funny and super offensive, and he goes one of the two ways. He plays a lot of ethnic characters because he does have mixed ethnicity.
Right.
So sometimes they're okay. Sometimes they're cringeworthy. This one he's playing a native Hawaiian, and it's over the top. But again, my friend who passed, he was raised in Hawaii. White guy raised in Hawaii, and that was one of the. I would ask him sometimes about movies that are set in Hawaii or take place in Hawaii. I would ask him, you know, how much of this is kind of real to the culture, how much of it is not. He said that Rob Schneider's character was actually pretty real to the culture. He knew a lot of guys like that.
Wow.
He also said when the first one I asked him about, by the way, was Lilo and Stitch. Because he had kids, I have kids, and our kids did play together at different points in times and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I had asked him at one point. I think we were watching Lilo and Stitch with the kids, and I'm like, so what part of this is kind of realistic? As well, they did pretty good with the background stuff. It's lush and green and beautiful there. And then the scene where the Lilo, the little girl, beats up the little white girl. Beats up the little white girl with the red hair and the glasses.
Right.
Says, yeah, that's probably the most realistic scene in the entire movie.
Whoa.
I'm like, really? He goes, oh yeah. Girls out there in Hawaii, they'll just throw it out and fight no matter what. And it's usually one of the native girls fighting a little white girl. I'm like, okay, that's good to know. He goes, hey man, I'm just telling you. Asked what was true. I'm telling it like it is.
All right. Okay.
No, sir. But
cool. Anyway,
to the topic of Spam. This has become, again, these are things that I'm always reminded of when I think of Spam. I'm reminded of my friend. I'm reminded of 51st Dates. And the reason it's come back into my memory and to the forefront of my mind recently is my sister-in-law has located a food truck near where our housing development is.
Okay.
That is, certain nights of the week, food trucks show up at the gas stations that are near our housing development. For it's a pretty decent housing development, you know, fairly nice houses. So but we're far away from any fast food places. There's like you have at least a 15-20 minute drive to get to even a Taco Bell, a Burger King, a McDonald's, and those are the things that are like everywhere.
Right, for sure.
We have nothing really by us. So the food trucks are kind of a boon for us. I mean, you pay a little bit more money at a food truck, but you typically get way better food than fast food. And more variety than just a burger and fries and what passes for an attempt at Mexican food at Taco Bell.
Yes, but understandable.
You pay a little more, but you don't have to drive, and the food is so much better; it's worth the money. I mean, do you buy the hamburger at McDonald's for $2, or do you pay $7 and buy the hamburger at Five Guys? I'm not saying Five Guys is a food truck, but it's better food.
You pay for what you get. Yeah.
But this specific place that she's been going to, it's an Asian food truck. It's like an Asian fusion food truck. And right. The thing that she keeps getting at this food truck is a spam and rice dish. And I just keep like, why aren't you picking me up some of this crap? Because I love me some spam too. Spam is great. Okay. I'll have some spam and eggs. I'll buy a can of spam and I'll just, that's great food right there. That's amazing.
Dude, okay. And, so I am not very like, I have not had spam in an extremely long time. I am not well versed in the ways of spam. But you're making me want spam because you keep just not just saying the word spam, but you're mixing it up with how well it goes with other stuff. It's starting to get at me here.
Well, what I find nice about it is it's like one of those things that, okay, if you're making chicken, right? Let's say you're making chicken.
Okay.
What do you put on the chicken for seasoning before you make it?
Oh, you're man. You put in
some salt, pepper, maybe some. You have your own seasoning, some garlic, maybe.
Yeah,
some
a little onion, bit of. Yeah, some. I do. It's kind of all over the place. There's actually a really, really good poultry seasoning that I have in the cabinet that I use on almost anything that is a bird.
Okay. So now if you're having. Steak, you got a seasoning that you put on your steak, right?
Right.
Or if you buy a really good steak, if you buy a really, really good steak, like if you get a T-bone or a porterhouse or something like that,
right.
The only thing you technically should be putting on it is salt and pepper. And if you put anything else on it, then you need to buy better steak. Because, I mean, a really, really good steak just needs a little bit of salt and a little bit of pepper.
Right.
And if you put steak sauce on it, stop listening to this. If you are a listener and you use steak sauce on your steak,
nope.
Just don't ever order steak again.
Nope.
Just order chicken. Because what you're telling me, you don't love steak. You love steak sauce. Just take a shot of steak sauce and eat some chicken and don't embarrass yourself. Okay?
Okay, so here's the issue that I've heard with steak.
Hard stand on that.
I get you. I understand. But the thing is that if the steak is not cooked right, and you can fuck up a steak easy. Like, steak is pretty simple for the most part.
Then you should, but you most should people, make it yourself.
Huh?
Here's the thing. Either you should make it yourself, or you should only order steak at a place that cooks the steak right.
Yes, don't exactly. And that's the point that I'm getting at.
Yeah, don't order a steak at Applebee's. They will mess it up.
Yeah.
Because they mess everything up. Their food is disgusting.
Yeah, that's why they offer you the steak sauce, because it sucks.
You know, there is a place in the Sacramento area that I would definitely order a steak. In fact, every time I go there, I order the porterhouse steak because it is flipping amazing. But, like, again, order a steak. If it's a steakhouse, order a steak and order a good steak. Order a steak with a bone in it. Don't order that New York strip steak because you're getting screwed with a New York strip steak. Order yourself a T-bone because that has New York strip steak and the filet mignon all in one package, and there's a bone in there which actually helps flavor and cook it properly. But what do I know? Anyway, we're not talking about steak.
Okay, I did not know that. Normally, I'm like, yeah, New York strip or sirloin, but that's my cut.
The big side of a T-bone.
Yeah,
that's what they cut the New York strip off of.
I'll be damned.
So screw getting the New York strip. Get the damn T-bone or the porterhouse, which is the bigger portion of the T-bone. Get those. Those are so much better.
Ah.
Plus, again, the bone adds flavor. The bone helps it actually cook better.
Get
the damn T-bone.
Yeah, will do.
But anyway, the point I'm making is you season some steak to some extent.
Yeah.
If you're doing most pork products, you season them. Except for there's one pork product you don't really season because it's already been seasoned in the curing process, and that's bacon. You don't really season that.
Right, you don't. You just kind of throw it down, and that's it.
And you have things like corned beef, which is already pre-brined and seasoned and whatnot.
Yep.
There's some things that require it. Now, admittedly, the spam gets its pre-seasoning. But what's beautiful about it is you pop it out of the can, you slice that weird shaped loaf thing into a couple of slices.
Right.
You just throw it into the pan and fry it up in the pan. You don't need no oil. You don't need no butter because there's enough fat in there that it just fries up. It's a beautiful crisp on each side. It's so amazing.
Really?
Melts in your mouth. A beautiful flavor.
Okay.
This is one of my kind of favorite treats to give myself. A Spam and Egg breakfast, some Spam with some scrambled eggs. You cannot go wrong with that breakfast. This is amazing. Spam can be used in so many things.
You are really selling me on this, man.
Sandwich. Like, you can break it up into little cubes and put it in. Okay, like here's a freaky take on breakfast burrito. Get yourself hash browns, right?
Okay.
Throw hash browns as your base in your burrito. Throw some scrambled eggs on top of that. Take your Spam after you've cooked it. Chop it up into little like cubes. Cube it up. Throw that in there, and then your choice of hot sauce or salsa or whatever else you put in there. Boom! Whole different take on a breakfast burrito.
Okay.
If you want to put cheese in there, you can put cheese in there. I don't like mixing cheese with my eggs. It's just a personal thing. As much as I love cheese, real cheese. Make sure we're clear on this.
Hey, I have cheese. I have cheddar in my fridge, bro.
That's good. I'm just saying. I'm not saying it to you. Don't think I'm coming after you about this. Or if you think it's about you, then it is about you because you're thinking it. But I'm not coming after you. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
I'm just saying real cheese.
Okay? All right.
I'm just saying real cheese.
Right. No, I get it.
I'm fighting against the love of American cheese. It's disgusting. People should just get rid of it. Real cheese. But anyway. It's a whole different take on your breakfast burrito because the flavors that Spam will bring in is they're milder than say like a chorizo, which hey, I'm all down for chorizo and eggs in a breakfast burrito. That's a nice little thing. Although interestingly lately, turkey chorizo really good instead of beef or pork.
I'm gonna have to find turkey chorizo. I have never found turkey chorizo. Where do you find your turkey chorizo?
I will tell you later.
Yes, please.
I've only had it once, but it was actually really good because it was a little. For me, I'm not. I don't deal with super spicy food too well.
Oh yeah.
I'm a little too pale for that. So and so are my intestines. So the turkey chorizo is actually a little bit milder than your beef and your pork chorizos.
Right.
And so it's a little easier. It was a little easier going down. It was a little easier coming out. So those are good things for me.
I'm a chorizo nut, dude. I love the hell out of chorizo.
That doesn't surprise
me. Too much,
but
actually.
The Spam gives you a different flavor profile than like sausage in your breakfast burrito or bacon in your breakfast burrito. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different flavor profile. It's kind of a nice flavor profile. So Spam means a lot to me. It's an important food. I love it. I only get it occasionally because I like it. The sister-in-law is never around enough to eat it with me, so it's usually just me eating it. The wife doesn't like it, and the grandmother's kind of on the fence with it. She'll eat it, but it's not her choice. These are all the people in the household that might possibly eat the Spam. So it's left up to me, and a can of Spam it's a decent amount of Spam. I mean, I think it's like half a pound for a can of Spam, and I can do that. It just isn't healthy for me to do that on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Eat that much meat in one sitting. But anyway. The thing that's brought this back to my brain was these Spam and rice bowls that my sister-in-law has been getting. And I was thinking about it. I remember way back when the first kind of introduction to Spam that I got, and it was actually as a kid. And I had a friend that lived down the street. I believe he was Vietnamese, but his family ate Spam all the time.
Okay.
And it was kind of, at the time, it was just some weird canned gelatinous meat thing that smelled kind of good, but had a kind of a weird smell.
Okay.
And it seemed so foreign to me. And I will admit, I was raised in a household that was, as far as cuisine went, was very, very much your classic bland American cuisine.
Right.
To the extent of, like, you know, baked or fried chicken and mashed potatoes or baked potatoes and like corn for your vegetable. That was like a regular meal at my house growing up. When we went a little wild and my mom decided she was going to make like tacos, this is what tacos was at my house growing up. I think I've discussed this before on the podcast, but just to give a better enlightenment for the specific conversation right now.
Okay.
So that people don't have to go and look, where did James talk about tacos before? Give me the information now. Tacos when I was growing up was ground beef, right? Browned ground beef,
right,
with a little bit of garlic salt, seasoned salt, and pepper.
Okay.
Fried corn tortillas.
Right.
Shredded cheddar cheese. At least we got real cheese there.
Right.
Real cheese. And maybe if my mother had bought some lettuce. That was tacos. That's all that came with tacos.
Oh, man. Okay. So you even had, I mean, that is bland for even white people tacos, man.
Oh, it gets better. My mother, when making her own tacos, would put ketchup on her tacos.
What in the hell was wrong with your mom?
Oh, we need a couple podcasts for that. So. Especially okay, when it comes to food stuff.
No. Okay.
Actually, I'll make a quick encapsulation for you. Okay. Here's the quick encapsulation. My mother lived at a time, obviously, because of the age we're at, our parents would have lived at a time where their parents made food and you ate it whether you liked it or not, and you ate everything on your plate. At least in some households. My mother grew up in that type of household where her parents made their food. And there's like, my mother would tell me stories about them making her half a chicken. Each her and her brothers, half a chicken for dinner, plus sides, and they had to eat everything on their plate. Even if they were full,
that is so much food.
And I have trouble with half a chicken sometimes. Like, I go to El Pollo Loco, get me half a chicken. I don't always finish it.
Yeah, dude, a chicken is a lot of, by itself is a lot of food.
It is. And then add sides and everything else in it. And this is being fed to preteens and teenagers. It's a lot of damn food. But anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a mistake.
Let me finish.
Okay, because my brain hurts at the concept here.
There was a lot of foods that my mother was forced to eat because that's what was made and what was on her plate. That she could not stand eating. And the only way she got around being able to eat these things was by putting ketchup on them. Well, as she became an adult, instead of stopping making any of these foods or making them in other ways that would make her want to eat them, she just still made these foods and covered them in ketchup, like scrambled eggs. We'd have a breakfast, which is probably the most flavorful meal that was made as I was growing up. We'd have breakfast and, you know, you got scrambled eggs, you got bacon, you got fried potatoes, you got waffles. I would make a sandwich out of all of that because it's amazing to have a sandwich made out of all of that.
Yes. But it is.
You know, my mother would have all of these separate pieces and she would cover the eggs the scrambled eggs in ketchup. And I think I asked her one time, why do you do that? Because it's the only way I like eggs. I'm like, well, if you don't like eggs, why are you eating them? You're an adult. You don't have to. And she kind of gave me a blank stare. I'm like, but they're eggs. I'm like, so don't eat the damn things. If you don't like them, don't eat them. I don't. If I don't like something, I don't eat the damn thing. Nobody makes me eat anything that I don't like. That was actually my entire childhood. People hated me for that. The fact that if I didn't like something, I just wouldn't eat it. I wasn't the person who would, like, out of politeness, eat something that made me sick. I would just refuse to eat things. People would get so, especially adults, would be so mad at me as a kid, glaring at me like, how dare you not eat this thing that I made? Well, I'm sorry, I don't eat that crap. I don't eat eggs when you cover them in cheese. I like cheese, real cheese, but not on my eggs. See, I'm keeping it all together.
That's fine. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, that's actually, I was kind of part of that too, the you're going to eat it and you're going to like it whether you like it or not kind of crowd. Like, I was that kind of a kid too.
I was lucky that my mother's policy was, my parents' policy was, we're going to make what we're going to make for dinner. If you don't like what we make for dinner, then in the cabinet there are a bunch of cans of pasta, there's cereal, there's bread, there's peanut butter, there's anything else you want to make. If you don't like what we're making for food, go ahead and make yourself something else. We're not making you something else, especially once I was a teenager and whatnot, you know, preteen teenager when I could use a microwave and cook my own food.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, we're making what we're making. We know what you do and don't eat, but we're making what we're making. If for some reason you don't feel like eating our food, go make yourself something else and you can eat what you want to. That was kind of thing. And that was mainly because my mother was forced to eat so many different things. It used to be great when we'd go to her parents' house for Christmas Eve and for Thanksgiving. We used to do that for many years, probably the first 13 years of my life. We went to their house for Christmas Eve and for Thanksgiving almost every year. And when I would be sitting at the table with my cousins were raised in that same type of household where their parents made their plates for them and told them what they were going to eat, and they had to eat all of it. I never had my plate made for me until I was at my grandparents' place or at somewhere else, somebody else's place,
yeah,
that wouldn't let kids make their plate for them. At home, I just grabbed what I wanted to. Whatever was there, I grabbed the pieces and the amounts that I wanted to. The only rule was if I put it on my plate, I can make my own stuff, but if I put the food on my plate, I either needed to eat it or save it and eat it later.
Fucking sense.
If you only want to take a little bit, you can go back for seconds, but don't pile a whole bunch of stuff on your plate and then waste food because you got too full. Take a little bit, eat what you can. If you want more, go get some more. And if you do have some left over, save it and eat it later so you're not wasting food. That makes a lot of sense to me.
That makes so much sense. Like, I did not have, like, that wasn't what was put in my mind. Like, overall, there was, I had a split family. One side of the family was, you know, take what you want and eat what you take. And that's fine. Like, that was one. But then another side of my family was more like, this is what we're making. You're going to have it because this is what we're making for dinner.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, you're either not eating or you're going to eat everything on your plate. Like, period.
Yeah. See,
your plate served up, you better finish it because we busted our ass to make this, like to have this on the table. That was the idea. And now it's kind of funny because I tend to see now I overeat. I also will eat damn near anything. I'm non-discriminate when it comes to most food, unless you put ketchup on a taco. What the hell is that?
Believe me, that's always the fun one to tell people, because that's where people like ketchup on their scrambled eggs. Some people could be like, all right, I can understand that. When you say ketchup on a taco, it's like, what? What the hell? There was no hot sauce in our house, by the way. Never any hot sauce growing up. My dad would buy Pace Picante salsa, but that was his salsa to be used to eat chips with while he was watching football games.
Right.
Now, my dad actually had a much more expanded palate, specifically with Mexican food. He was a huge fan of Mexican food. And he would make himself some Mexican food dishes, some real spicy, real nice Mexican food dishes.
Mm-hmm.
But as a kid, I was always too afraid to try any of those things.
Oh, man.
Because they were all weird. There were all some weird dishes. I was very, very picky. I kind of followed some of my mom's form for many years. When I became an adult and started getting out more with different food things, my taste buds expanded, my flavors expanded. Again, there's still my few hard no's. Raw fish, still a hard no. Avocado, throw it away. I still have my places where, like, nope. And I can say this at least this much. I've tasted avocado. It is disgusting and gross. I want nothing to do with it. I haven't gotten to the point of trying the raw fish yet, so I'm not ready to do it yet in my life. There may be a time when I am. Now is not it. So I can say that one is still, I just haven't gotten over that hurdle, that mental hurdle yet to be able to do it. But I can say with a fact, avocado is nasty. I want none of it. But anyway, this is kind of a portrait of what my childhood food, life was like. So this other family having this, to me, exotic food with this fam, because I didn't know any better. I was raised with very little outside culture. My family was, pure Americana. So, to see something like that was just really weird. And I could never get myself to a point of being brave enough to give it a try. And that lasted through my entire childhood. I mean, I screwed up my high school senior trip by being the only asshole who decided he didn't want to eat anything at all at the Cambodian food restaurant that we went to on our senior trip.
Oh, man.
And demanded that I be taken to McDonald's afterwards to get food because there was nothing there that I was going to try, because that's all weird food and I don't try it. I was a total dickhead that night. Completely and utterly. At the time, I felt like they were all being asses to me because they knew, these people knew I didn't eat food like that. why would they want to go to a place like that? I didn't realize these are all people that have not, they've grown up in the middle of nowhere and had no ability to go to a cool restaurant like this. To them, it was this weird, neat new experience where they get to try all these foods that they've never seen before because they lived up in the hills and it was a cultural wasteland and right. They were trying to expand their horizons. And you have little, you know, douchey kid here who spent time living in the Bay Area at one point in his life, so you'd think he would be one of the people that's more open to these things. He's like, no, I'm not eating this crap. I'm a little bitch. Because I was a little bitch. Hey, I have no problem admitting to my faults. I am somebody who can admit to my faults and be okay with it, because I think it proves the inner strength. I know I was a little dick back then. I've had to prove it to family over and over.
Right.
I've had my dad be surprised watching me eat corned beef hash with fried eggs on top, breaking the yolk on the fried eggs, mixing it all together and eating it. And my dad's just looking at me like, how the hell are you doing that? You eat fried eggs? When did you start eating fried eggs? And you mix it up with the yolk? How do you do that? I'm like, why don't you eat? And he's doing the exact same thing with the exact same food. Well, yeah, but I've never seen you do it. I'm like, well, I learned how to do things, Dad. or going to a really nice Mexican food restaurant with my brother. And he was first time he's bought me food in probably 15 years, maybe 20 years.
Right.
I go out to dinner with him, and he was just shocked that I said, he said, hey, you want something to eat? We can go to this Mexican food place. I was like, sure, yeah. And he's looking at me like, what? Because he remembers having to stand in line at McDonald's to get me a new hamburger because they had put ketchup and mustard and pickles, the normal thing they put on, you know, the little hamburgers.
Right.
They put that on there, and I needed the burger completely plain because I wasn't going to eat it. You couldn't even scrape the stuff off. I wasn't going to eat it because the flavors were there, and I couldn't deal with it.
Right.
He remembers that. That's the last time he remembers going anywhere to eat with me and being responsible for eating with me.
Oh man.
As I'm a jerky little kid. And so he orders this. We're ordering our food, and he orders a burrito. I order the same burrito. I'm like, yeah. The only difference is I don't want the avocado on it. Well, you want some guacamole on the side? Do you not get my desire to not have avocado anywhere near my food? No avocado.
No, and thank then, you.
And it's, you know, it's one of them big, gigantic, you know, 4-inch round, 5-inch round burritos. It's like 6 inches, 7 inches long, you know, just gigantic.
Oh, yeah.
Huge thing. And filled with rice and steak and all kinds of veggies. And it's great, beautiful, big burrito. And I just tear into that thing and devour the entire thing. And he's just looking at me like, eyes agape, just like, what the heck is going on?
What have you done with my brother?
And I said, it's weird, isn't it? He goes, what do you mean? I said, you have the same look that Dad had. What do you mean? What look? When I went out to eat with him one time, you have the exact same look on your face. How the heck is he eating this? He would never have touched this thing. You know, I grew up, I learned a few things. I tried a few more things. Now I can eat a lot more. He's like, yeah, it's really weird. I keep having you in mind as a little kid. I know. Now I'm a big fat kid. It's a whole difference. But anyway, this ability of mine to later in life branch out with my food loves made this food spam, this thing that as a kid I just thought was weird and beyond my understanding of food. I mean, that was one of the most exotic things I remember seeing as a kid. How lame was my childhood? But as far as food went, that was like super, super exotic, and oh my God, you know, that's just strange. And then as an adult, to finally try it, to enjoy it, and to have it be such a favorite thing of mine, because it really is. It's a special treat for myself. Even though it's not very expensive, it's still a special treat when I get it. However, like so many other things in my life, whenever I fall in love with something or find something that I have interest in, I'm a person who loves to do research about a thing. Like for instance, we had our a couple of episodes ago, we had our discussion about Metallica and our favorite songs from Metallica albums.
Right.
And I had friends when I was younger that listened to Metallica. We discussed this, but I didn't really get into Metallica until the Load album. That's the first one that I bought. That's the first one that I got into. And the first thing I did after getting into Load and buying Load was go back and buy all the previous albums and just devour all of them, all the information I could. The stuff that I kind of half heard secondhand, I devoured it and made it part of my being. Because when you love something like that, you try to know as much as you can about it. You do as much research as you can about it.
Right, totally.
Same thing same thing that happened with my entire growing up about the 49ers, which is something else that I'm, you know, so passionate about. I always knew about Star Wars, so there was never a moment where I just went back and delved in. I just was always involved in that. Probably same with the 49ers. But, you know, anything like that, if I've fallen in love with something, I do my best to try to find the whole history of it, find out everything about it. Well, interestingly enough, that even comes together with food items that you would think, oh, I just like this food item, so I'm just going to eat this food item and it's going to be great. No, I go back and research it. I'm talking, I get weird research information like, okay. My favorite soft drink, for instance, this is a little sidebar. My favorite soft drink, my favorite cola is Pepsi. I am a Pepsi drinker.
Okay.
Pepsi over Coke.
Right.
Unless I'm mixing with alcohol, then Coke over Pepsi. Coke just tastes better when you're mixing with alcohol. You know, you don't get a rum and Pepsi, you get a rum and Coke.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There's a distinct flavor between the two colas, and one's a good mixer and the other one's really not.
Yeah, another example, you don't get a Jack and Coke because Jack and Coke is terrible because Jack is awful. That isn't quite the same thing, but whatever. Point I'm making
I am not letting you say that with me on the air.
I am saying that.
No, I will not stand for that, sir. Jack and Coke is nectar, my friend.
Okay. I'll take a Crown and Coke, personally. But anyway.
Crown and Coke is all right. Crown's, you know what, for me personally, Crown just has too much spice in it for me to dig.
Crown and Pineapple is even better.
Crown and Pineapple is good. It must be the spice of the Crown and the Coke. I've had Crown and Coke. It's okay. I just don't dig on it. Jack and Coke, there's something about, like, Jack as a sour mash just kicks you in the gut and in the face and in the eyes and in the nose when you have it as a straight shot. But
and I don't like to be kicked.
I understand that.
Hence my desire to not have it.
Right, and I understand that. But I can understand how when you put whiskey, most whiskeys, or Jack Daniel's specifically, and mix it with Coke, it sweetens it up a lot to where it's just a really nice sweet drink. But dude, that is Lemmy's drink of choice, as it is also mine. I will vehemently deny your opinion of Jack Daniels and Coke.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying, man.
Doesn't change it. But anyway,
you don't have to, but I will not let, let this aggression stand.
It's still going to be there forever, man. But anyway, I I'm a Pepsi lover normally. Did you know that at one point Pepsi had like the sixth largest navy in the world? Did you know
what?
That? Yeah, just a quick sidebar.
We're not
story
talking like military it. Navy here, right?
Yes, actually, yes.
Pepsi owned a naval fleet.
Yes, they were given one.
What the hell? Who gave Pepsi the Navy?
I'm getting there. Let me get there. They made a deal with a specific country to provide that country with Pepsi, and that country was supposed to pay them. But because of the laws in place in that country, they weren't allowed to use their money to pay somebody outside of their country. So instead, they gave them basically a fleet of warships. Submarines, destroyers, all that kind of stuff.
I'm Googling this shit when we get off the air.
Now, here's the thing. Guess which country it was. What country would be crazy enough to give away a fleet of warships to Pepsi?
Dude.
And basically as collateral for the money that they were owed.
I don't even know where, like, who the hell would have a navy to give people? And, like, what did they die?
Think of the craziest country that would do something like that. That would be that. I mean, the thing is, it makes total sense because this is a country that would be like, well, I can't give you any money. Here, have a submarine. What country would do that?
Who, like, what, Germany? I have no clue.
Oh, come on, think bigger than Germany.
Bigger than Germany?
Ireland
has a coastal. Bigger than
Ireland
Germany?
Ireland doesn't need submarines. Huh?
What, like China?
Close.
Shut up.
It was Russia.
Russia gave Pepsi a naval fleet.
Yes.
Like people and submarines. Like they're talking.
I don't know if they gave them people. I don't know if they gave them like the people to man the ships, but they gave them ships.
What did they they do with those ships? Did they sell them to somebody else? Did they?
That part of the story I don't remember. I would have to do the research.
Did they deck them out in Pepsi flags? Like, what did they do?
Maybe they were part of the Pepsi Points program back in the 90s, late 90s. You remember the Pepsi Point program?
Oh, yeah.
Remember they did the jet at one point? Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it was. He's like, have a submarine. No, that wouldn't make.
That might have been the next phase. Is, you know, here's a submarine. Here's an ICBM. Who doesn't want their own ICBM in the backyard?
I mean, if they get naval fleet, if they get an aircraft carrier, do they get planes as part of it, or is that a completely different thing?
I don't know if they got an aircraft carrier as part of it.
Did they get weapons? Like, you have to wonder how much they got.
Yeah, no,
are you just getting the boat? Or are you getting the nukes that go on the boat? Like, what happens?
And again, this is a real thing that actually did happen. These are things that I researched. So I actually at one point decided to research spam, where it came from, what you know, anything, see if there's anything special about it. And guess what I found out?
What did you found out?
Spam is actually really, really important to the world.
Really?
In fact, spam may actually be responsible for the Allies winning World War II.
Believe that? Oh, man.
Yeah. So we're going to take a break right now.
Okay.
I think this is the appropriate time for a break.
Yeah.
When we come back, I'm going to tell you how spam helped win World War II.
This sounds fantastic.
And this the thing is, this is actually all real. You can even find all of this well, I'll tell you later where you can find it so you don't stop listening right now. You'll find out at the end. But anyway, we'll be back in just a minute.
All right.
Hey friends, this is Mike from the Xennial Chronicles reminding you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Zenchron, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N, to keep up to date on all things TXC. And please check out our official website, thezennialchronicles.com, or if that's too much to type, zenchron.com. Thanks again for listening, and now, back to the show.
And we are back.
Hey, hey, hey.
And so, into your slight history lesson.
Yes, please. I'm super eager.
First thing to explain is what spam is.
Okay.
Spam. The name was coined for it. Back when it was made, July 5th, 1937 is when it was first introduced.
Okay.
The brother of a company executive came up with the name of it, got a $100 prize to name it.
Wow.
They won't, the Hormel company who owns Spam won't say what the actual meaning of the name is, but popular belief is that it's an abbreviation of spiced ham.
Interesting.
But it may or may not have other meaning. Who knows?
Okay.
And 1937 is a key as to when it was made. But what it is it's pork shoulder, which at the time was not a very desirable cut of meat. You didn't have a lot of people doing pulled pork and whatnot as major restaurant food. That was considered kind of poor people's food. And if we're being honest, in our day and age, that was also considered kind of, good way to say this, it was food for people of color. It was cheap, fatty parts of the animal that were basically sold to what at the time was considered the less important part of the population. And again, that's what they would have been thought of at the time. So many of your families that were people of color during that time, specifically Black Americans during that time, would have been buying pork shoulders as their meat of choice because it was inexpensive, and cooking the way that you would get inexpensive fatty cuts of meat to be palatable is to cook them at a low temperature for a long period of time.
Right.
To gelatinize that fat and make the other tissue in it very tender and juicy. And that's how you get your various pulled pork products. If you're doing a really good, like smoked pork butt, you're right. Working with shoulder. You're working with pork shoulder,
right?
Same type of meat that's used to become spam. And again, at that time, at that time, the United States, much like myself when I was a kid, had not grown up and opened up their taste buds to other cultural foods. Now you don't go. I mean, now you go specifically to barbecue places. You can get some pulled pork, so you can enjoy yourself some really good barbecue pulled pork, smoked pulled pork.
So wait, hold on one second. So I can kind of understand and synopsize this a little bit. the idea of with pulled pork was essentially, if I could go there for a minute, pulled pork sounds like food that white people didn't know how to cook and they didn't like it.
Yes.
So
yes,
part of the oppressive culture from that time essentially put that part of the pork in the hands of those more disenfranchised, and it essentially became soul food. And then it was reinserted into the population
actually,
as a popular
actually,
food.
Actually, most of your soul food, most soul food is based on parts of animals that were not popular for white people to eat. And so the black culture at that time, that was the food that they could afford because it was the cheaper pieces. It wasn't the prime pieces that that white people like to eat.
Wow.
The affluent white people like to eat.
Right.
And so even the idea of brining and frying the legs and wings of chickens. White people wanted chicken breasts. That's all they wanted. So legs and wings were considered the auxiliary pieces that weren't wanted and thus were cheaper, and it became actually part of the cultural food.
Whoa.
I'm saying this. I want to admit that I am saying this from the point of view of a white person who was raised in a white American household.
Right.
This is just the things that I have learned from research that I have done. This is obviously not part of culture that I grew up in, and I only understand a minutia of the culture just from research and learning that I've done.
Oh yeah,
it's
totally
not something that was taught to me or a part of anything that I had growing up. But yes, that is traditionally how it has happened. Many of the foods that are part of what we consider soul food now, or even Southern cooking now, were foods that were the leftovers and cast off pieces of things that the affluent white people didn't want. The black culture of the time made amazing stuff out of it because it was still amazing food. It was just the undesirable part of the food. I mean, yeah, you also have to recognize bacon was considered undesirable part of a pig until an ad campaign in the post-World War II era trying to get rid of this huge surplus of pig belly.
Wow.
A huge ad campaign was put through that bacon and eggs was like the perfect breakfast to have. It was a perfect middle-class breakfast. You know, have your cup of coffee, your bacon and eggs while you read the newspaper, and go off to work. And
wow.
So otherwise, it was considered low meat, not something that everybody wanted. Lobster in Maine used to be prison food until the invention of refrigerated train cars that could actually move the lobster without it spoiling. And then an ad campaign basically made lobster out to be a delicacy. Prisoners in Maine rioted because they were being fed too much lobster.
Wow.
These people had the right idea. They were like, no, we don't want no giant ocean-going cockroach anymore. Screw that thing.
Well,
the ad people came in, and the ad people said, hey, everybody, look what we have from here. We have these huge, giant, beautiful things. Look at all the meat that's inside them. It's wonderful. Dip it in some clarified butter. It tastes fantastic. It's a delicacy. You can't find them everywhere. You want these, and you're willing to pay for them.
That's
why people think lobster that's why lobster is what it is.
Okay, so just to kind of throw it out, the evolution of so much delicacies at this point, I just really find it hilarious that it comes from the fact that white people don't know how to cook their damn food. I will call it out as it is. Like, that's one of the funniest. That's one of the funniest jokes in world history white people conquer for spices they don't know how to use.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, America is we're such an amazing country in the sense that whatever cultural identity the original people that lived in this country had has basically been destroyed because the European settlers, invaders, let's call them what they were. The European invaders basically wiped out the entire native culture of the United States, first through disease and then through, you know, killing them and taking their land.
Right, right.
So our actual native culture only comes down to like, hey, look, we can call corn maize. Literally, that's and turkeys, by the way. That's otherwise the native culture of America has basically been wiped away and destroyed. So there's very little examples of cultural native food. We have a few here in California, but it's very limited, at least for the United States part of America.
Right,
Right.
Some of the other areas have.
It's one of the most fascinating parts of our history and our culture. Like, to be completely honest,
And then what happened is, as we brought people, as more people came in from different cultures, suddenly we started having all of these upwellings of great food here in America. But every single one of them is based on a culture, a food culture from another country.
Yeah.
You know, it's Italian food. And it's French food, and it's Mexican food, and it's Chinese food, and it's Japanese food, and it's Indian food. And, I mean, really, the only thing that is really American food is something like McDonald's. And that's barely American, because French fries are Belgian, hamburgers are technically German, and, I mean, I guess we can own chicken nuggets, but do we want to?
Yeah,
America has no cuisine of its own. They even try to claim apple pie is American, but it's not.
It's not, no.
No, it's nope. not. I believe it's either German or Austrian.
I think it's German.
I mean, California or America doesn't have its own real food culture. It has to take from all these other food cultures you could really say it that way. We can say it, I guess, as white people. White people don't know how to cook food on their own. They need to learn from other cultures.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's like the first. That's the first thing when I learn about. That's one of the things I love about the options and the places that you can go. I am always willing to try food I've never tried before, especially from a culture I've never tried their food from. Because doing something right.
You are, like I said, I am now, but when I was younger, yeah, no, never would have happened. Never would have happened.
Right.
Hell, we can't even claim the ownership of sandwiches. That's British. So
yeah, there's
that's
nothing
probably the
that,
only good food thing they did.
I mean, I think, you know what? I think the only thing I believe, and a lot of people, pizza technically was done in New York, but like.
Well, okay. The version of pizza that we know was done in New York,
right?
But they had the basis for it was a flatbread that was made in the Naples region of Italy. So I mean, there's precedent for it before pizza was actually made.
Right. It's the manufactured pizza of today is more of an American thing. That's the thing about the American culture. The American culture is really good at manufacturing original ideas.
Yes.
See, McDonald's is an American food. McDonald's is an American food because it's a manufactured burger. It's manufactured fries.
Everything is assembly line.
Yes. That's what we're good at. Well, that's our calling card to food.
Thank you, Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Well, and that's
our calling card.
And that's what happened with Spam was you took this meat and ground it up, basically made it into this homogenous loaf and canned it and turned something that was a cultural food, by necessity, cause it was cheap and expensive, but otherwise, at least to the main market, to the larger market, to the, let's be real, white market of the time. Boy, we're getting political in this one. I kind of like it. I think we should do more of that. But anyway, they make this loaf thing. And what's nice about it is, it takes something that is always an issue when it comes to food, something that is a perishable item, and turns it into a non-perishable item. It turns it into something that's storable, that's potable. You know what I mean? This is something that can sit on shelves for a decent amount of time.
Oh, man.
You can this. People can buy them. People can keep them. Well, the time frame, 1937, kind of coincides with some world events that are happening.
Right.
Some tiny mustachioed art student who got kicked out of art school and decided he wanted to cause some trouble decides to cause a whole crap ton of trouble.
All because he didn't know how to paint.
Well, the funny thing is, he actually wasn't that bad a painter, but people didn't like his painting. So, you know, somebody that's got a little bit of a confidence issue and people are criticizing his stuff, he decides to go overboard. I'm not trying to belittle the situation of the horrors of what that man did.
No. But look, the capability of some is immeasurable in some instances, in, you know, both the positive and the negative sense, I guess. Not to get too deep into it, but yeah, I mean,
this guy decides he's going to start invading a whole bunch of countries up in Europe.
Can we at least agree that the guy's a complete dick?
Yes, okay, of course he is.
Okay, just to make sure, like, this is not something that's essentially a positive outlook here.
No, he's a douchebag.
Yeah.
One of the worst douchebags in history.
Absolutely.
So he decides to start going around invading a bunch of countries in Europe, throwing a bunch of people into prison camps, ovens, that kind of stuff. General douchey things.
Yes.
Exceptionally douchey. Not even general, exceptionally douchey things.
Just overall, he's an excessive dickbag. That's pretty much what happened. And then he had a bunch of other people do it with him, which is a total dick maneuver.
And he starts making some alliances with some countries. He makes some alliances with Italy, who was being led by another complete douchebag.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's...
You know,
let's make sure that we're just like, hey guys, we're doing all this dumb stuff over here. Want to be friends? No, the general public's like no.
It's like, Guten Tag, I'm a douchebag. Buongiorno, I'm a douchebag too.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. We're talking specifically between two assholes.
That's kind of what's going on. And then at the same time he's doing that, and you have Japan gets involved as well, and they become what we call the Axis powers later on. They all kind of treaty up together. Now, at that time, Hitler decides to also kind of try to make good dealings to some extent with Russia, because Russia is just friggin' huge and kind of in the middle of everything.
Right.
So they're like, hey, tell you what, Russia, we're invading all these places. We ain't going to invade you. You don't mess with us. We don't mess with you. When all this is over, we'll give you a little bit of area, in the eastern part of Europe. We just want the rest of it. And Russia's like, all right, I mean, you're a douche, but you're going to give me some, so I'll just sit pat, no problem. Well, the United States, after having been involved in World War I, didn't necessarily want to get involved in another World War where Germany was causing trouble again, because that's what happened in World War I.
Right.
And by the way, World War II, part of what was the kind of vacuum of things that gave Hitler the ability to rise to power in World War II or before World War II and then start doing what he did for World War II was a direct result of how the end game of World War I was handled. This is a history lesson for a whole different time.
Oh, yeah.
But World War II happened because of what happened after World War I.
Yes.
In many ways, that's responsible for all the problems anyway. U.S. was not wanting to get involved directly. However, they were sending arms, ammunition. They were sending soldiers over. There's pilots that went over to England to help fly against the Luftwaffe coming in and doing the Blitz in England, bombing England. One of the things the United States...
Yeah, one of the things that we're really good at is not only manufacturing, but also making a ton of money. We do both of those things very well.
Yes, America likes to make money. I like money. but anyway, one thing that America did decide to do as part of their pre-war war effort was they kind of stopped Japan, which is Japan's an island nation, right? When you're on an island nation, you have a limit to your resources.
True.
Well, one of the resources that would be very limited with Japan, especially considering it's a volcanic island. There's a little bit of geology that has to go involved in this. I mean, you know, it's a volcanic island. Mount Fuji is a volcano. It's a giant ass volcano.
Yes. I did know Mount Fuji was a volcano, and that's kind of like a really big deal.
Yeah, Japan is basically the top of a volcanic mountain.
Yes.
All of Japan is. This is the part of the mountain that's above sea level. Just like Hawaii. That's the part of the mountain that's above sea level.
Yep.
Although Hawaii is a weird one because Japan is actually in a subduction zone, so you expect volcanoes to be there. Hawaii is actually in the dead center of the Pacific Plate. So the reason that that volcano exists is actually an upwelling in the middle of the plate, and that's why the Hawaiian Islands have that kind of weird curve to them, you know, the various islands. This is where the Pacific Plate has moved over this upwelling, because the upwelling is below the Pacific Plate. So every time that upwelling is punched through, it's created a new island, And so, you know, thousands and thousands of years from now, there will be another island in the Hawaiian chain southwest, the southeast of the current Big Island. That's how that's how Hawaii works. Sorry,
I did not know that.
I dabbled a little in geology. There's only a few places on the planet where you have the those upwellings in the middle of plate tectonics. Most of the time, volcanoes are on on plate boundaries,
right.
The subduction zones. The subduction of one plate underneath another plate is right. What causes the magma chambers to form and it's what caused like the Cascade Range of volcanoes in Northern California and up through Oregon and Washington.
Wait a minute. Does that make Hawaii an anomaly, or does it make Japan an anomaly?
Hawaii is the anomaly. Japan is on the Ring of Fire. It's at the subduction zone
okay.
where the Pacific plate and the Asiatic plate meet.
Gotcha. Okay. So and Hawaii seems to be there. More active. Doesn't it?
That has no bearing on the location of where the volcano is. Has no.
That's interesting. I did not know like any of that. That's actually
one of the other big mid-continental upwellings is actually Yosemite National Park. That is right. The entirety right. of Yosemite National Park is a giant caldera, and
yes.
it's an upwelling in the middle of the North American plate, which is a very, very thick continental plate, and for some reason there's an upwelling magma chamber in the middle of it. There's no other volcanoes anywhere near that because it's the middle of a plate. You shouldn't have a volcano there. It shouldn't exist. It's an
right.
upwelling of the magma chamber. So those two, Hawaii and there, and I think there's one more somewhere over... forget exactly where it is. No, the one in the caldera in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean's all part of a plate. So,
whoa.
But yeah, it's just that's plate tectonics, a whole nother thing. But yeah, the Yosemite one and Hawaii, really weird that they're in the middle like that. But anyway,
yeah.
Japan itself is again, it's an island, it's a volcanic island, so it only has so many resources. So
right,
one of the
right,
resources
right.
that they don't have is they don't have oil reserves. Because in a volcanic island, you're not going to get oil reserves. For you to have oil reserves, you have to have had places where dinosaurs specifically have died and then decomposed, been buried under, you know, tons of rock, and then basically turned into crude oil by the pressure from all that rock. Because life is we're carbon-based life forms. That's what oil is basically a carbon-based product.
Right.
And so oil comes from, you know, dead dinosaurs.
Right.
And Japan, being a volcanic island, it doesn't have its own oil reserves. It has to get oil from other places. Well, during World War II, one of the things Japan was doing was invading up and down the coast of China. It invaded into the Philippines, into China itself. In fact, they in the invasion into the Philippines, they sent General MacArthur leaving the Philippines. But they were trying to get territory, and they were trying to get oil. Well, the United States effectively cut off the oil going to Japan and all the shipping routes. Well, by doing that, Japan had about 6 months of oil left before the entire country would be completely dried up of oil.
Right.
So Japan decided that they were going to take action against it and planned an attack on Pearl Harbor, which they did.
So that's and why they did it.
That's why they attacked Pearl Harbor.
So it wasn't a power move. They were looking for oil.
They were basically lashing out at the country that cut off their oil supply.
Gotcha. Okay.
So this catapults the United States into World War II. There are many theories around it, whether the United States did it on purpose so that Japan would attack them, so they'd have enough reason to get support to jump into World War II. There's so many things about it. We're not talking about that right now. Another podcast, another time.
Yeah.
But you had the United States then hop into war against Japan. When they declared war against Japan, immediately Italy and Germany declared war against the United States because they were, you know,
Axis powers
connected together with Japan.
Right.
And so the United States hopped into war against Germany. Germany also decides around this same time. Now, I'm not getting exact dates right, but this is just it's just part of the weaving of the story of spam. Because spam is what we are talking about here with the context
well,
of
so
World
much
war
that goes II. Into it. Yeah.
Germany decides that they're not going to honor their kind of agreement with Russia, which, I mean, the Russians kind of should have seen that coming because, like, if the douchebag at the party, like the head douchebag at the party, says he's going to leave your shit alone and then hook you up later, do you really believe him? If you do, that's your fault. Because you know he's going to screw you over.
Right.
Well, Hitler says, I'm going to screw you over. He did not pay attention to historical precedents, which, by the way, it's a very important thing to pay attention to historical precedents. I'm not saying you let it completely control you, but if the same type of events, like, I don't know, a massive pandemic happens, right? And people can stop the pandemic from happening by wearing masks. People refuse to. And you have multiple waves of the pandemic so big that this pandemic creates such a huge thing that it's actually in history books under the heading the Spanish flu.
Yeah, the 1918 Spanish flu.
Because, by the way, the reason it's called that is because the only country that actually truthfully reported numbers of sick and dead regularly was Spain.
Yeah.
Because every other country at the time was involved in World War One and didn't want to show weakness as to how many people were actually dying. I think something like 20 million people died during that, more than what died during the wars. I may be wrong on my number, but it was a large number.
Wait, are you trying to say, I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Am I trying to say what?
Are you trying to say that hiding numbers and stopping people from knowing exactly how deadly something is actually extremely dangerous?
It is very dangerous to do. And I'm just saying that when we have things like that and we find ourselves in conditions that are much similar to that, mm-hmm. we should really look at the historic precedents and see how much trouble they had previously in the way they did and try not to do things the same way.
Yeah.
This is where absolutely. Hitler made his mistake. He attempted to invade Russia. He tried to start a land war in Asia. Now, we have been told by the movie Princess Bride that that's not a very smart thing to do. But if we had studied European history, we would know that Napoleon tried to invade Asia.
Yes.
He tried to start a land war in Asia. He tried to invade Russia, and it didn't go very well for him either. In fact, it was basically what sent him into the spiral that ended with him being deposed and living out the rest of his island or his life on an island where he was poisoned by the wallpaper to death. True story also. The wallpaper poisoned him to death.
Was there lead in the wallpaper?
Arsenic, actually. It was used to make a green coloring that was very popular during that time period.
Wow!
Wallpaper, especially because it was kind of a tropical subtropical island, so like it leached out of the wallpaper from all the humidity and stuff.
Oh man!
Whole different story. But
yeah,
if Hitler paid
choice.
Attention to his history, if Hitler had actually paid attention and researched what Napoleon had screwed up on, he would have realized that it was a bad idea to try to invade Russia, especially if you try to do it as winter is coming along, because that's a really bad time to do it. If you're invading somewhere, you need to be able to keep your supply lines. So if you don't have your supply lines, you're not getting your food, your munitions, your reserve soldiers. You need to have those. And it was difficult because the weather, the massive snow was making it really, really difficult for him to do it, but he almost succeeded. Actually, the thing is, he almost did it. He actually probably could have succeeded. Because of the siege of Stalingrad. Stalingrad was kind of, I mean, if you remember the movie Enemy at the Gates, that's a really good one for the siege of Stalingrad. It's not true, but it's still
it's enjoyable.
A good one.
I did not see Enemy at the Gates, actually.
Okay.
That one's a little while back. That's around our Blockbuster days is when that came out, right?
It was, yeah.
It's one of those, Ralph Fiennes is in that, right?
Yes, Ralph Fiennes, Ed Harris.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to
think of who else in there.
It's not bad for a guy who never watched the damn movie to understand that that actor was still there. Some of my Blockbuster memory still serves me well.
Ron Perlman.
Ron
Perlman was in it, and then, I'm trying to think of the girl that was in it. She's the one from the first two Mummy movies. I can't think of her name right now, but anyway, not important. Bob Hoskins was also in it. I think Bob Hoskins was Stalin. I'm not sure.
Rachel Weisz.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Germans kind of had Stalingrad surrounded. They were starving them out. And thing is, the Germans had at the time in World War II, they had some of the, until the United States entered, they had the best technology. Even when the United States entered, the United States was doing its best to catch up to German technology. In fact, after World War II, too, when the United States was kind of helping clean everything up, they went in during something called Project Paperclip and basically snagged away as many of the German scientists as they could, specifically their scientists for munitions and rockets and things like that. Because at that time, the rockets that they were building in Germany, they were building rockets to fire from Germany to land in like England and stuff. We're talking ICBMs before ICBMs even existed.
Yeah.
They were really far ahead in that technology. With Project Paperclip, the United States just grabbed them all, brought them to the US and put them into NASA. And they are what is responsible for the Saturn rockets and the rockets that the Apollo rockets, everything those are the Gemini rockets. Everything that sent basically men to the moon and men into orbit, German scientists were responsible for. World War II German scientists.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Whoa.
Because their technology was up on things. And so when they were invading Russia, they had this technology to go against them. What Russia had that Germany did not have was a shit ton of people. In fact, more Russians died in World War II than every other country's deaths for World War II combined.
Really?
More Russians died.
Holy shit.
Because there's another thing that you don't know about that happened the same day that the bomb was dropped in Nagasaki, and that is that there was an area of China that Japan had invaded and had taken over, and the same day that the bomb was dropped in Nagasaki, Russia invaded that area of China that Japan had taken over and basically destroyed the entire Japanese encampment there. Everything that Japan had taken over, they destroyed it. So that actually, we don't teach that in American schools. We just teach, hey, guess what? Truman decided to drop a couple bombs and Japan said, oh, crap, we surrender. No, there was actually a Russian attack on the mainland held area that Japan had. And Russia just stormed into there and destroyed everything.
Well, that would make sense that we wouldn't mention it, because when we were kids, the Cold War was still happening. Like, yeah, Russia was the bad guy. Didn't even mention
that.
We
didn't want to say anything good about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the thing. That's why we didn't learn this story. So Stalingrad
is fascinating, dude. I never learned about that.
I'm not done.
Oh, man, like okay.
Stalingrad was being surrounded. Millions of Russian lives were being lost. Germans, a lot of lives lost there, but they had the better technology. They were sieging this city, and the city was starting to starve until they started seeing shipments of food. Now, not only were the shipments of food going into Russia, but the shipments of food were going across the Pacific. And who was bringing them? The United States. Now, as the United States, I'm going to shift to the Pacific theater real quick. As the United States was island hopping across the Pacific, trying to get to an island base close enough that they could effectively attack the island of Japan, mainland for them.
Right.
And that's what the whole island hopping was about. They had Hawaii. But if you look at it, if you look at a globe, Hawaii is really, really far away.
Yeah.
From Japan. I mean, the Japanese fleet had to go all the way across or at least halfway across the Pacific Ocean in secrecy to make that attack. It was a one-time deal. It wasn't going to happen again.
Yeah, you can't just like hop off of you can't hop off of Oregon or Alaska or
Alaska,
Hawaii.
You
could do it from Alaska?
And actually, there were some of the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. Yeah, some of the Aleutian Islands in Alaska were actually being occupied by the Japanese during World War II.
Oh, so obviously, Alaska wasn't exactly fully in that. That was
it
not
wasn't a state yet.
Oh, it was just a territory. I did not know that.
It was just a territory during World War II.
Okay,
and we barely had a road that could get to Alaska. The Alcan Highway was barely in existence at that point in time.
Okay.
It was just basically a dirt road that half the year you couldn't even traverse through. It was almost impossible to get up to Alaska. So Alaska was not really
it's not a viable option at this point. And you couldn't just like launch out of like San Francisco or Oregon and hit Japan. Like you can't do that. We didn't have that capability. That is way farther away than you could assume.
Yeah, you had to refuel too much. The technology at the time wouldn't allow those type of things.
Wow.
So So that's where the island hopping came in. That's why you had to go to Midway, to Guadalcanal, to Iwo Jima, all these different islands, to Okinawa, to get all these islands to be able to control this, to the back to the Philippines and bring General MacArthur back to the Philippines. And as they were coming back, one of the things that ended up coming with the soldiers was this new product, this inexpensive canned product that could travel all over the place. It had meat in it, so it gave you some kind of protein.
Protein
it
sustenance.
Gave you the meat that you wanted.
Yep.
And
long-term
spam. Spam went with the army. It went with the military all across the Pacific, which is why in Hawaiian cooking, in Filipino cooking, basically every single country up and down the Southeast Asia and all through the Pacific Islands, Spam has actually become a huge part of their culture and of their food products, because during wartime, when things were rationed and things were, you know, difficult to find, this was a storable food product. That I mean, they didn't have to worry about spoilage. They didn't have to worry about how long they could keep it. And it was being given by the military to people to help these various peoples when they were rebuilding. Well,
that's fantastic.
At the same time that happened through the Pacific in Russia, since they had started fighting against the Germans, and they basically became, yes, people, the Russians were our allies in World War II.
Yes.
They were. There are pictures of Stalin and Franklin Delano Roosevelt sitting and talking together, and Winston Churchill sitting and talking together, trying to work things out, because we were all allies at that point.
Well, this was one of those situations, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. We had to take in some instances, we had to do that. And that's, man, you know, all's fair in love and war, right? So
what ended up happening was Russia suddenly started getting this influx of spam. And it just so happened to be around the time that the siege of Stalingrad was happening. And Russia was able, they had no other food sources because everything had been destroyed as the Germans were marching forward. That, you know, the whole countryside is being destroyed. They were running out of food. They were starving. And that's what that's what you do in a siege. You try to starve out the enemy.
Right.
Once you starve them out, it's easy to just march through the city streets.
Yeah.
All of these starvation problems and these issues in Stalingrad, the shipments started arriving, the relief shipments of food, and spam was one of the chief things as of this relief of food.
Yeah.
And the Soviet army was able to push back the Germans, push them all the way back to where their attempt to invade Russia was basically what helped to start their downfall on that front. And then on the other front, you have D-Day happening that brings the downfall from the other side.
And so they were closed in on both sides at that time.
But to give you an idea of how important it was, in his memoir, okay, Khrushchev remembers, Nikita Khrushchev, you know who that is, right?
Yes, I do.
You know, banging his shoe on the table guy?
Yep.
Nikita Khrushchev declared, anybody who's listening who doesn't know who Nikita Khrushchev is, look him up.
Yeah.
He was basically a very high-ranking political figure in Russia during the Cold War.
Yeah.
He declared, and again, in his memoir, without spam, we wouldn't have been able to feed our army. Throughout the war, countries ravaged by the conflict and faced with strict food rations came to appreciate spam. This dude in his memoir thanks spam for saving the army.
Dude, that's amazing.
And to know, so to realize that this humble little food that's sitting in the grocery store with all the other canned meats that people make fun of, oh, it's spam, that little me thought was some weird exotic food, actually was what fed people in the Pacific Islands as their homes were ravaged because of war, and what helped the Soviet army be able to push back the Germans and help World War II be won. That's just amazing to think that this little can of ground up pork shoulder had that big of an influence on the world.
That's insane.
It's amazing.
That just, all right. So I would consider at that point that spam is something that America as a country should be proud of.
So wait, can we say that spam is true American cuisine?
Yes.
I can't really think of anything else. Spam is our cuisine.
Spam is, okay, think about the details of spam, okay? The details of spam and the way that it's made. It's as American as anything else. It is canned, manufactured pork. That's what it is. That's as American as you could possibly get as a food. That's as American as McDonald's is.
Okay, So here's what I'm saying right now. Here's what I'm saying right now. I'm going on record for this.
Okay.
It's on the podcast. It's on record. Veterans Day, Memorial Day, D-Day,
dude.
4th of July.
Yes.
Spam is the new food that you need to eat on those days.
100%. I am freedom, fully behind you on that. Fully behind.
If you love freedom, if you love your country, you need to recognize that that food, more than any other food we have ever made, spam, is what helped save the world back in World War II.
Dude.
It's more American than anything else.
Dude, I am right there with you. That is dope. I am right there with you. Yes. That is the moral of this episode. I would call it 100%.
And I'm gonna challenge anybody that listens to this. And I'll put it out on those days. Again, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, the anniversary of D-Day.
Yep.
And hell, let's throw the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, so Pearl Harbor Day in there, and the 4th of July. I'm gonna write this out. Post it on the Facebook.
Yeah.
Post it on Twitter.
Yeah.
This is real. You need to have spam to celebrate what spam has done for this country, what spam has done for this world.
Yes. Yes.
And celebrate it 100%, as the American
dude.
Food that helped to save the world.
I love
the
it.
American food.
I love it.
And I want pictures. I'm gonna be asking on those days for people to post pictures
yep.
of themselves enjoying spam and being patriotic and loving their country.
Yep.
Just please, please, if you do it, don't do it on like American flag plates or with American flag.
Oh, no. That's a terrible idea.
That is in violation
nope.
of flag code.
Yep, absolutely.
Respect the flag. Don't put it on something you're going to throw away, because that's not respecting your flag.
That's exactly right.
So that's did I blow your mind completely with
you
the
blew
spam?
My mind, bro. You blew my mind, and you made me like such a fan of spam in like an hour and a half worth of time. That's not even funny. This was fantastic. I am so happy with all of it.
That's good. Well, Mike, here's the part of the show where I ask, where will people be listening to us?
Well, if you're listening to us on our official website, it is called thezenialchronicles.com, or you may have typed zenchron.com if you don't want to type that much, which we understand. We are also on basically any of the major podcasting forums. We're on Spotify. We're on TuneIn. We're on Apple. We are also on YouTube as well. We are also on Google. I'll mention Google. We are also on YouTube as well. If you're listening to us on the podcast, you can also subscribe to us on our YouTube channel, which we would love if you could.
Please
subscribe and hit that bell icon, especially if you're listening to us on YouTube right now. And I believe that is...
Well, and of course, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. As I said, that's where I'm going to post the list of days
yes.
where people should enjoy spam, celebrate spam. It is the American food. And
yes.
I'm going to do whatever I can to promote that. I'm just little old James living here in Northern California that my voice only goes so far. But I will do whatever I can to push spam as the true American food, the world-changing food that we need to have more respect for. And we need to... celebrate.
Yes, absolutely.
On all the days
I think
that we celebrate the greatness of this country.
That's, dude, I think that's amazing. And dude, spam has now become on every major American holiday, spam is going to be incorporated in some way, especially like barbecues and stuff. Dude, you're either going
to
barbecue it
to
or you're going to have it out on a sampler plate or what have you. Like creative spam usage like needs to be a thing. Definitely needs to be a thing.
I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
Right? Dude, I'm going to get in some spam this week. I can't not now. I can't.
Good luck, by the way. It's one of those things that, interestingly enough, gets snagged up really quickly during, those pandemic things that if we paid attention to history, we would know how to deal with better.
Well, that makes total sense. Man, everybody's talking about a shortage of toilet paper. Why isn't there a shortage of spam? Unless there is. I mean,
there is,
I don't
there
know.
Is.
There's
the
a shortage
there
of spam
is.
As well. It makes sense. It's shelf stable. It's shelf stable for like
exactly.
days. For sure.
How can this not be the most American of foods?
Dude, anyway, right?
Thank you everybody for listening. Hopefully I've inspired you to get some spam. Hopefully Mike has inspired you to have different ways to consume your spam.
Yeah.
And you're feeling the same as he is.
I'm excited.
Thank you all for listening. And we'll be back again with something next week.
Y'all have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in, friends. The journey continues next week.